getting very exciting now, isn't it, Esther? As long as you haven't peaked yet, you don't know what's coming up. The story's getting very exciting, I think. You remember, in this whole passage, this whole story, where Esther has become the queen, and she is in a position of responsibility, a position of some authority in many ways. And last time we looked at how she came before the king to make a request on behalf of her people, the Jews. And she risked her life to do that, didn't she? She risked her life to come, and the king accepted that, and he welcomed her in and asked what she wanted. But she didn't tell him. Rather, she invited him to a banquet along with Haman. And after that, she still wouldn't say what she wanted. She'd want to have another banquet tomorrow that you can come to, and I'll tell you then. We followed Haman, didn't we? And after the banquet, he was in high spirits. He was on his way home, and he came across his dreaded enemy sitting at the city gate, Mordecai. And that ruined his day completely. It made him quite downcast. And he was very upset because he doesn't like Mordecai. He's issued this decree to have the Jews killed, which is in the offing. And he's really upset that Mordecai is still not honouring him as he should do. So when he gets home, he tells his wife and his friends about all this. And they suggest, here's a good idea. Why don't you hang him? What a great idea. We'll build a great big gap. And you can hang him. And of course, Haman, being this all-powerful man, second only to the king in the kingdom, he could do whatever he wanted. And so he gets all puffed up with his own self-importance and his own pride, and he gets a bit above his station, and he thinks, yes, I can do that. I'll just get the king to sign it off in the morning, won't be a problem, and I'll hang Mordecai, and that'll be the end of him. And we noted, didn't we, last time we looked at this whole business of Haman's pride, and we saw that through his pride, he became very self-sufficient. He thought he was the centre of everything. He thought he could do whatever he wanted to do. He thought he was running the show. And we saw, didn't we, that how mankind, too, is consumed by pride. And that's demonstrated in the way that we try to put ourselves in God's place. We try to be God. We want to be up top. We want to be number one. We want to be running our own lives. We don't want some deity outside interfering with us. We want to just carry on and do what we want to do. So mankind has rebelled against God and chosen to live for themselves. Even the church, very often, people have decided that they know better than God. They choose to live by their own ideas and their own opinions rather than the truth that is revealed in God's word. Jesus expects his disciples to submit to him. And in that respect, pride has no place. Well, this week we're going to see what carries on in this story with the king. And really, I suppose you could say it's a story of coincidences. Have I got my PowerPoint, Julie? No, that's a reading. Yeah. Can't get the staff, honestly. Right, thank you. Is this a series of coincidences that we've got tonight? Let's have a look. What happened first of all? Well, the first thing we read, as we follow the king off now, we've seen what's happened to Haman. Now we're going to go to what happens to the king. The king has a sleepless night. Well, we've all been there, haven't we? For various reasons. We've all been in a situation where we can't sleep. Some people sleep better in church than they do at home, I seem to realise. But anyway, why couldn't the king sleep? Maybe it was the rich food he had at the banquet, giving him a bit of indigestion, and that was causing him a problem. Maybe he was wondering what Esther wanted to ask him, and that was playing on his mind, and he was thinking about that. We can speculate, can't we, as to what the cause was, but actually I know what the cause was. The cause was that God prevented him from sleeping. God was preventing the king from sleeping that night, because he had a purpose in mind. It was no coincidence that the king couldn't get to sleep this particular night, because this was vital to what was going to happen. You see, God doesn't leave things to chance. God was in control of this situation. Although we're not told what's going on here, in the sense that we're not told what God is doing, God is working in all of this situation to bring about his will and his plans and his purposes. and he doesn't leave things to chance. Now, if the king couldn't sleep, those around him couldn't sleep either. And all you husbands know what that's like, I suspect. He's restless, and he needs something to do. No TVs to watch, no computers to play with. He can't go on Facebook and look at his friends. So what does he do? He gets his servants to go and get the record of his reign, so that he can read all about his own wonderful achievements. He goes and gets somebody to read his biography to him, basically. So they're reading through this. It's obviously taking quite a long time. And eventually, they come to this part where Mordecai has given information about a threat to the king's life and stopped the king being assassinated. And suddenly the king sits up and takes notice and says, hang on, did we do anything for Mordecai? Was he rewarded in any way? But they couldn't remember, or the king couldn't remember, if Mordecai had been honoured. You know, in Middle Eastern cultures, and the Persians, and Middle Eastern cultures today, it's considered the height of bad manners if somebody does something for you and they get no reward in any sense. It's a shameful thing to happen. And the king's attendants confirm that nothing was done for Mordecai. It would probably have stuck in their minds that nothing was done, because they would have realised at the time that the king should have rewarded him, and they would have been surprised that he didn't. So the king decides that something has to be done for Mordecai. At last he gets remembered. But what? Well, clearly the king has been up all night now. And luckily, just at that very moment, who should arrive but good old Haman. He arrives at the court. He's come there with he's been there nice and early. He's got this plan to have Mordecai hanged on his gallows, and he wants the king to just sign it off for him. So he's turned up nice and early, and he just arrives just at the right moment. So there's another coincidence there, isn't there? And I think what follows here is almost like one of those comedies on television, one of those farces almost, where Haman comes along, and he's the bad guy of the piece, of course, the bumbling king who hasn't really done very much at all, and the good guy Mordecai. And what follows is where Haman gets completely the wrong end of the stick as he goes and talks to the king. And we see here Haman's misconception about what's going on, don't we? Haman has come to the king with the intention of getting the king to rubber stamp his execution plan for Mordecai. And he's still full of his own self-importance. You know, the king's going to do this to him because he's such an important guy. The king's already done what he's wanted. He's already signed a decree to have the Jews exterminated, so he's certainly not going to worry about this one man, is he? So picture the scene. There we are. The king, with his thoughts firmly fixed on honouring this man Mordecai. Haman, with his thoughts firmly fixed on killing this man Mordecai and his position of influence with the king. And as Haman comes to see the king simply says to him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honour? Now, the audience, that's us, we're looking at this story. We sit back and we know what's going on. We know they've both got different things in mind. And we wait to see the comic outcome of this story. Haman, of course, a man full of pride and his own self-importance, thinks the king must be referring to him. Who else could the king be referring to apart from me? I'm the only person worthy of really being honoured by the king in this way. There's no one else that he could think of. So with this in mind, he thinks to himself, what would I like the king to do for me? And he comes up with a grand plan to have himself, thought, paraded around the city, wearing the king's clothes, riding on the king's horse, and being looked after by one of the king's nobles. And once again, Haman's pride takes him to that place where he wants to be king. Can you see that? The king's clothes, the king's horse, the king's servants, all at his beck and call. He wants the people out in the streets to know that he is really important. He is like the king. He wants the world to know what high esteem he is held in. What a fantastic idea, says the king. That's a great idea. Go and do it. But then comes the sting in the tail, doesn't it? Go and do it for Mordecai, the Jew. And make sure you do it all properly. Now, can you imagine Haman's face when this is said to him? In the matter of a couple of seconds, Haman's pride and pomposity is completely demolished, isn't it? Everything he's built himself up to be, in one word from the king, is completely demolished. He realizes he's got to give all this honor that he thought was for him to his greatest enemy, the man he wanted to execute. Well, there's probably no point in asking the king to sanction that execution now, is there? You know, we must be careful that we don't allow ourselves to be puffed up with self-importance. That we don't allow ourselves to become full of pride and think that we're better than we really are. Because pride will be the architect of our humbling, if that is the case. When we build ourselves up, we're building ourselves up for a fall. It's exactly what happened to Haman. Because he thought himself better than he really was, he ended up falling from a great height. Haman has indeed been humbled, hasn't he? Last time, read from Proverbs 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. And that's exactly what's happened here to Haman. And it's a warning for all of us to make sure that we don't think of ourselves more highly than we ought. And the twist here is that Haman really pronounces his own punishment, doesn't he? In a sense. Remember when David committed adultery with Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet came before him and he gave this scenario about a man stealing somebody else's sheep to David, and David said, you know, that man should forfeit what he's got because he's stolen from somebody else. And then Nathan said, that's you. Again, David there pronounced his own judgment, didn't he? And that's what Haman's done here, in effect. He's pronounced his own judgment. Haman really decrees his own downfall. The penalty for Haman's pride was his enemy was exalted. Haman has to swallow his bitter pill. He has to take Mordecai, dressed in royal robes, riding this royal horse throughout the city. And he has to do it himself. We don't know how long it took, but I guess it wasn't a short trip. I should think it took a while to parade Mordecai through all the streets of the city of Susa. So you can imagine the way Haman must have felt. Totally humiliated by what had happened. Haman's pride was the architect of his fall, wasn't it? This man who had been puffed up with his own self-importance was now humiliated and humiliated in moments. We don't know how Mordecai reacted to all this. We just read afterwards that he returned to his position at the king's gate. I imagine he was quite pleased to see this man who hated him, who had ordered the destruction of his people, having to humble himself in this way. But it doesn't say very much, and perhaps it made a great impact. He doesn't seem really fazed by what happened there. He just goes back to work, effectively, doesn't he? Whilst proud Haman has been humbled, Mordecai, who was humble, has been exalted. And Haman, on the other hand, slinks off in despair, covers his head in grief. He's totally devastated by what's happened here. All of his plans shattered. God always humbles the proud. If you're a follower of Jesus, you cannot walk with Jesus in a haughty, proud manner. It can't happen. Jesus wants disciples who learn from him in submission, not to exalt themselves and their opinions. He wants people who will listen to him and follow him, be guided by his teaching. Haman's plans for disposing of Mordecai gone horribly wrong, haven't they? But, he thinks, no doubt I'll get home and my wife and my advisors will bring some comfort to me after all of this. They'll come up with some good advice. But what happens? Unfortunately, Haman ends up on his own, doesn't he? The day before, his wife and his advisors have been full of good advice of how to rid himself of Mordecai. Yes, they said, you know, you can do what you want, you're a great man, go and hang him. Now, things have changed. And far from supporting him, they all back off, don't they, and leave him isolated. Look at what they say to him here. Your downfall has started. You cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. These were the people, the day before, keen to share in his glory, keen to offer him advice and stand by him. Now it's gone wrong, they've backed off. They're going to let him take the fall. They've deserted him. He acted on their advice, with their encouragement, but the responsibility is all his. They've effectively thrown him to the wolves, haven't they? All of a sudden, they point out there's actually no chance of Haman defeating Mordecai, because Jewish origin, they say. You had no chance to start with. Presumably, the stories of the Jewish people have been handed down through the generations, and people were aware of how the God of the Jews looked after his people. Many nations were aware of the Lord of Israel. Ezekiel 38 tells us that God's name is not broadcast just within the confines of Israel, but it's broadcast through all the nations. All the nations, he says, will know that I am God. Remember Jonah, and the sailors were terrified when they heard he was a Hebrew running from the Lord, because they'd heard of the Lord, the God of Israel. People were aware of the Jewish God, and they still believed that you couldn't defeat the Jewish people. You know, you've almost got to feel sorry for Haman here, haven't you? In a way. Now he's reminded Jews have divine protection. His wife and advisor say, you didn't stand a chance, really. Why did you go and do something so silly? They told him to. And just as he feels his world is collapsing around him, what happens? The king's eunuchs turn up, take him away to the banquet. It says they hurried him off to the banquet. You can imagine him not really wanting to go, can't you? Whereas before he was eager and keen to go to his banquet with the king and Esther, now things weren't looking so good, were they? Now his whole outlook has changed dramatically, and he's probably not very happy about going off to this banquet. There's a lesson for us here too, isn't there? We need to be careful what advice we listen to. We need to be careful of those we take advice from. We need to make sure that we listen to those who you see follow God's word. They're the people we should be listening to. We must be careful that we don't listen to the wrong people who would lead us astray from what God has laid down in his word. Haman has gone from right up here to right down here in the space of a day. Harold Wilson said, didn't he, a week is a long time in politics. Well, a day is a long time in Haman's case. Things have changed around completely. There's an old joke that says, do you know the secret of good comedy? Timing. Isn't it? And this is what this is all about. This is God's timing. As we look through this story, what do we see? We see God's incredible timing with every aspect of what goes on here. There was a threat to God's people, and God knew it was coming. And we can see how God meets this threat in the most remarkable way. Just think about what we've read so far. Queen Vashti upsets the king and is banished. The king gets depressed and looks for a new queen. Esther happens to be the right age, in the right place, at the right time. And she just happens to come first in the beauty contest. And at just the right time, after Haman issues the decree to kill all the Jews, she is able to come to the king. And he just happens to offer her anything she wants. Haman decides to do away with his enemy, Mordecai. And that night, the king just happens not to be able to sleep. And he just happens to be reminded of Mordecai, who he just happened to forget previously. And just as Haman turns up to ask the king to sanction Mordecai's execution, the king happens to be intent on rewarding Mordecai. And it just happens that Mordecai's enemy should decide what honour should be given to him. A lot of coincidences there, aren't there? And there's others throughout the whole story. They're not coincidences, of course they're not. This is a pivotal point in the events of this whole story. And we can begin to see now, as we see what happens here, how the unseen God has been directing everything with perfect timing. What appeared to be a series of unconnected events, inconsequential things almost, they've suddenly gelled into a perfectly orchestrated whole, and it's all done with exquisite timing. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 reminds us there's a time for everything, and everything happens in God's time. It's God who's in control of all these situations. It's God's timing that is perfect. And God has control over time, doesn't he? And we, the audience sitting back, looking at this real life play that's taking place before our eyes, we see the hand of the unseen God directing all these events. We can see how these seemingly insignificant events are building into the big picture that slowly reveals God's plan. And that's how God works. We don't always get to see why things happen. We don't always understand the way that things happen. I suspect Mordecai may well have been a bit miffed about being ignored after saving the king's life. But think about it. If the king had rewarded him then, he would be dead now, and the Jews would be facing massacre. Had the king had a good night's sleep that night, the result would be the same, wouldn't it? That morning, he'd have granted Haman's request, and Mordecai would have been hanged, and the Jews would face extinction. They're not coincidences. All these things are perfectly timed events in the plans and purposes of God. Sometimes we look at our lives and we wonder, why is this happening to me? Why are these things going on around me? Why is God not doing this in my life? Why has God allowed that to happen in my life? Why are things not going the way I think they should be going? If you can't understand why things in your life are taking the course they are, don't get downhearted and depressed about it. Think about Esther and how God works, unseen sometimes, to do his will. Remember Romans 8, verse 28. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Just as God was working all things for the good of his people at the time of Esther, so he is today. We may not be able to see what's happening behind the scenes. We're privileged that we can read this story and we can see what was going on. We're privileged we can read the book of Job and we can see what God was doing behind the scenes. God's plans and purposes are being worked out, and he has in mind the good for his people. So if you're tempted to look at your life and wonder to yourself, why is God letting this happen to me? Go back to Esther. Have a look at Mordecai and see how he nearly lost his life, and at the last moment, God stepped in and worked it out for his good. God is in charge. God is in control. God's plans and purposes are being worked out, and they will be worked out. Continue to trust and rely on God, because everything that God does is perfectly timed to make sure his plans and his purposes are fulfilled.